welcome to Securing Sexuality, the podcast where we discuss the intersection of intimacy
and information security. I'm Wolf Gorlick.
He's a hacker. And I'm Stephanie Gorlick.
She is a sex therapist. And together, we're going to discuss what safe sex looks like in a digital age. And together, we're joined by Brad Renderman Haynes, hacker, security researcher, also the founder and chief researcher for the Internet of Dongs Project. How's it going, Renderman?
It's going pretty good.
It is always fascinating to me because when we started on this path, everyone I talked to said, hey, did you talk to Render yet? Have you looked at Render's site yet? Did you see his talk in this? So why don't you fill in our audience about what I've heard so much about in the past year in terms of what you've been talking about doing?
So the Internet of Dongs project is my research project to assess the state of security from a purely like informational, you know, Internet of Things standpoint of internet connected sex toys. This was a field that frankly has not been researched heavily because of, you know, societal hangups on things. Some companies just can't get over the giggles. It's something that I've found very interesting because it actually affects people in ways that you don't ordinarily think about with, you know, other Internet of Things, you know, products, your fridge, your thermostat, or anything like that. So the risk landscape and threat assessment is very different. So it's been a very interesting exercise.
For the non-hackers in the room, what do you do? What is the Internet of Dongs project? What does that entail for you?
Up until, you know, the last 10 years or so, everything was essentially a manually operated device. Now they're you know, so-called smart. They connect to your phone, which allows you to control them on your phone, or allow somebody else to control, or over the internet allow control at a distance. That last piece is what really got me interested in, because suddenly the threat is not just, you know, somebody attacking your device, you know, in the room or what have you. As I like to say, the Mongol hordes are at the gate. You're 100 milliseconds away from every jackass on the planet now. And they could all theoretically connect to your sex toy, or, you know, your account or something like that. So it's suddenly a very different world. These devices are not unlike a lot of other things you have in your home. They're Bluetooth that connects to your phone. There's a mobile app. The mobile app talks to company servers for your accounts and connecting to other users. There's a lot of security aspects along that path. And so, yeah, using the skills I have, I'm trying to assess these and work with the companies to basically get them as secure as they can be.
Now, we've talked to folks on this podcast about the privacy issues with sex tech, right? Like, does the toy gather information they shouldn't? Is it collecting and sharing this in ways it shouldn't? Is it posting it in places it shouldn't? Is that data able to be aggregated? I had one person who I was talking to who said, you know, when I realized that not only could my Fitbit tell, did I have sex last night, but it also could tell, did I enjoy it? And so there is this weird overlap on the privacy side, of course, which makes it very creepy. But we really haven't had many conversations about the security side. So I'd be curious to know, like, what are some of the common vulnerabilities you've run into?
The security of these devices when I started the project in 2016 was, frankly, terrible. Lots of low-hanging fruit, shall we say. The industry, you know, after finding a bunch of vulnerabilities and reaching out to the industry, they took note. They woke up very quickly and have made things a lot better. There's still room for improvement, of course, just as with any product, but it is way better than it was. The most common kind of vulnerabilities I have are authentication issues, where the passwords are being sent improperly, hard-coded passwords within the applications that are used for, you know, how the application talks to the back end, things like API keys that allow you to get in and possibly do a heck of a lot more than you were ever supposed to as a user. Poor data handling, you know, not using strong encryption and connecting the app to the back-end servers. Vast majority of that, like I said, has been fixed, but there is a subgroup of vendors that typically will just build a device for another company, slap their name on the box, and call it a day. They aren't incentivized to secure their devices as well, because after they've sold the device, there's no money to be made. There's no additional information, additional revenue paths, so they don't want to upgrade it. They don't care to. These ones are the ones that typically have a lot of problems with excess data collection, with you know, some of the aforementioned authentication issues, and it gets downright scary when, as you mentioned, like with a Fitbit, I can tell a lot of interesting information about you. If your fridge reports to the company, you know, how many times you open it in a day, well, A, you might not be proud of the fact of how often you're going for a snack, but the company receiving information from your sex toy or the app saying how many times a day you're using it to masturbate takes on a whole different meaning in society. It's just about metric, but people, when you suddenly associate sex with it, get really have different, you know, much higher opinions on it. You know, the case of WeVibe, when they got sued, part of 5 or 6 years ago now, cost them $5 million. In that particular case, the mobile app, the privacy policy that was in that app did not disclose that they were collecting certain information. Information like, you know, when you logged in, what your favorite pattern was, who you connected with, other, you know, diagnostic information, like there was a temperature sensor in the chipset that, you know, was used to tell if the thing was overheating. You know, that information was all sent to the company. The text they had in the app was actually the text from their website, which didn't mention any of the functionality of the app. So they really got caught on a technicality. They were collecting this information without actually telling people because somebody copy and pasted the wrong text. There was no evidence that they were collecting these, you know, major dossiers on their users or anything like that, other than, you know, what's the most common pattern people use, which, you know, is the kind of information we let companies collect all the time from us. You know, why does it matter, you know, what, you know, particular mood lighting color ever, you know, we use? That they'd like to know your favorites so they can, like, make sure that the next version of the product is able to do that and better or whatever. But when you associate it with sex, suddenly, like, knowing which particular vibration pattern you prefer takes on a whole other realm.
So I remember Peter Sandman talking about risk management way back in the day. I mean, way back in the day, like VHS tapes days, he was giving lectures. And at the time, what Peter Sandman was saying was, you know, we always talk about risk being the hazard, the harm. We always talk about risk as being the vulnerability. But really what drives a lot of the risk conversation is the outrage. Right? How impactful do you feel if this information is shared and leaked? And you're right, I may not care at all if you know the temperature of water I like, but I may be pretty outraged if you're sharing the patterns that that I'm using.
Well, not even necessarily the patterns, but some of them, the way that the apps were coded, could accidentally leak things like GPS information. Knowing exactly where you are, that suddenly takes on a whole other thing. The outrage is in certain ways justified. In the case of WeVibe, it's, you know, like I said, a screw up in the privacy policy. They weren't telling people they were doing this or why. But at the same time, it's something we allow everybody else to do, you know, in the IoT space. So why is the fact that you're associating with sex different? I always find this interesting. Because when I give talks, I always look at the audience and I say, yes, every one of you here, with maybe a few minor exceptions for like in vitro, are here because people had sex. Like, get over it. But it's when you get past the giggles. And I fully admit, when I first started the project, it was, you know, going to be for giggles and like had titles that would get selected at conferences. But once I started getting into it, into the research, I found how bad things were and what the implications were. And it took on a whole real level of serious very quick.
Can you give me some examples or tell us some stories about how these technologies have gone off the rails, how this has impacted the everyday user, the person that just wants to be in their bedroom with their vibrator.
There's multiple devices that I found that were accidentally leaking GPS coordinates, so I could tell which room of the house you were in. The scary part with that was on one of them there was a search function for being able to find other users and invite them anonymously to connect to your device. But the problem was they wanted a Tinder-like functionality where it would say how far away you were from the other user. Well, there's multiple ways to do this. Their developers took the easy way, which was to send the GPS coordinates between the users and just do the calculation locally. So if you just peeked under the hood at what was being transmitted, you could see the GPS coordinates for the other user. And with the search functionality, it would tell you for every user that came back in the search where their GPS locations were. I mean, this is like stalker dream kind of situation, which is dangerous. I mean, this is supposed to be anonymous, but very much not. You know, when I can tell which room of the house you're in, the most flagrant abuse or vulnerability that did get exploited was this company, QIUI, had a cock cage, a male chastity device that locked around the genitals and had a mobile app to lock and unlock the device, you know, paired over Bluetooth. Their app was, and particularly the back end services, was terrible. You could ask it to do certain functions, and in its response, it would actually give you the user's password in clear. And if you went through and iterated, you know, the user IDs, it would tell you their passwords. And you could use that to access other functionality and do things like change the password on the account, effectively locking them out, which is, you know, inconvenient. But in this particular case, the device required a key from the server to be sent to the app to then be sent to the device in order to unlock. So if your phone couldn't connect to the server or you were locked out of your account, you couldn't unlock the device. There was no emergency, you know, bypass or key or anything. If you got locked out of your account, you had to get really intimate with some bolt cutters. A researcher in Europe reached out to me to help interface with the company. And we tried to report these things. We got a hold of the company, reported them. Nothing happened. Asked for updates. Say, oh, yes, we're working on this. And then nothing happens. Months went by. We're trying to disclose this responsibly. I noted that a very cryptic tweet by some other researchers I know that occasionally delve into the sex tech field were expressing, you know, frustration at dealing with a sex tech company. I'm like, I just asked the point blank, is it QIUI? And they're like, yeah. They had been trying to get a hold of the company and report stuff for even longer. And they had found the same things. So we decided to kind of combine forces to say, hey, we now know of each other, guys. You've really got to get on top of this. And months went by. We were asking, do you have a plan even? You know, this is during the height of COVID. So we just want to see a plan, you know, some sort of momentum. And we weren't. Like, they came up with a new version of the app that actually was worse in a lot of ways. And finally, we were like, you haven't shown us anything. We're going to go public. And give us a plan. And so we went public. We didn't disclose any of the actual vulnerabilities. But you shine a flashlight on something like that, and it's so blatantly simple that everybody found it. And there was a lot of reports on their forums and on Twitter of people having their account passwords changed and being stuck inside these devices. The company had to post a video of how to, like, essentially break out of the device. You know, with a screwdriver. The interesting part was somebody wrote a Python script that essentially iterated through all the user IDs, changed the passwords, and then sent an email to the address in the account demanding a certain amount of Bitcoin in order to unlock the account. So we literally had ransomware for a sex toy.
But I think for those people listening who may be building toys, maybe being in the sex tech industry, one of the key takeaways, which I'm hearing from you, which we've talked about in so many other industries, but I don't think is being considered much right now in the space, is to have a process in place, have someone responsible for checking those emails, for responding, for replying, for engaging with the research community, so we can take some action when people like yourself find these things.
Yeah, there's two major things that I tell a lot of companies to do. One is a vulnerability disclosure program. Pretty much any company should be running this, you know, have a vulnerability disclosure program. They're not hard. The idea is if somebody finds a problem, you know, or a vulnerability, or, you know, doesn't even have to actually prove it, but just like, hey, this doesn't look right. Give the people a way to report this to those that can actually do something, not a general delivery thing that goes to a secretary that doesn't understand the you know, technical stuff, but have it go to like an actual technical person and first triaging. This should be a no-brainer because people want to do work for you for free. Let them. This is a simple business thing of people want to make your product better. Let them. You know, part of it is establishing a process internally for handling these, communicating with the researcher constantly, you know, letting him know that in 48 hours you're gonna triage this, test it out, let them know if it's actually a problem and what they're gonna do to fix it, you know, when they're gonna fix it, and just, you know, you don't even have to pay them, you know, as long as you don't. You don't have to pay them or offer any remuneration or compensation. You could just have a kudos page or send them a t-shirt or something. This doesn't have to be expensive, but it's such a basic thing. The other thing I pointed out to a lot of the industry when I first started reaching out was it was very interesting to me because these companies did not think of themselves as tech companies or software companies. They previously had, you know, electrical designers and stuff like that, that, you know, motors, batteries, et cetera, you know, materials designers that built, you know, these devices. Somebody got a chipset, you know, development kit from Nordic or Texas Instruments or somebody, put it in, you know, made a basic app. Hey, it works, ship it. These companies did not realize that they just opened up the door to a huge world of pain. And they don't go to the conferences like I do or Wolf does. They aren't aware of what they needed to do in order to secure this. They didn't think of it as something that was connected to a wider world. And so when you tell them, hey, you're a software company now, and much like sex, if you make one mistake, you're supporting it for the rest of your life. But it's interesting that they're making the mistakes that we've, you know, figured out 15, 20 years ago. This is not new territory. Like anything else, IoT, it's same as a nanny cam, same as a thermostat or fridge or stove or doorbell or whatever. Funny story about doorbells. I actually got my hands on one of the first cock cams, which was a genital mounted webcam, and took apart the application and found that the manufacturer had reused, you know, large chunks of the application over and over again in multiple different products. The actual hardware itself was the same as you'd find in a D-Link webcam. The application itself, you could tell, had actually been previously used on a video doorbell product, but they left the doorbell sounds, the MP3s of the doorbell sounds, in the app, which means that for the rest of my life, I will never have a shortage of ding-dong jokes.
I love that. And I think that what you're saying about sex toy manufacturers not thinking about themselves as a tech company is equally true on the user side, right? Like, my clients will buy Bluetooth-enabled toys or connected devices for when they travel, and they rightly think of them as relationship enhancers, as tools to help preserve and protect intimacy across a distance, but they don't necessarily think of those things as high-tech technology. They, in the same way that the manufacturers don't recognize the data that they're holding necessarily, I don't think that the users think often about just how intricate and just how adaptable, as you've just shown, these devices can be. So what can end users, what can my clients do to make sure that whatever they're bringing into their home and into their relationship is safe?
This technology is amazing. As you said, for long distance relationships and maintaining intimacy, as well as for exploration of different elements of sexuality, they are a wonderful advancement. The problem is, like with most high-tech stuff, people don't understand how their devices work. They don't realize that they're used to a remote control car or something like that as a remote control thing. You're thinking, it's in the same room, it's a short distance. But if you're connecting to somebody halfway around the world, yeah, that's not happening from a little battery-powered remote. So it's got to go over the internet. The internet's full of jerks who might want to mess with stuff. And people are always poking at stuff and finding things. The major thing is if they can monetize it. Bad guys, if they can't monetize it, generally will leave it alone. But there's always the people who just want to sow chaos. The other thing, too, is with some of these companies, the information they're collecting, if they're collecting it for responsible purposes, how are they storing it? I'm waiting for the first divorce case that requests data from one of these companies to prove that the guy has the app on his phone was connected, paired with his secretary's toy instead of his wife's, something like that. But most people need to realize that you're not special. Nobody is specifically going to be targeting you. You are not that interesting. I'm sorry. What they are doing is they're generally looking at things in aggregate. They're looking for, can I get the information out of all of the users? If there's like credit card numbers in there or something, or other personal information that they can use in some way, they're looking at an aggregate. So, making sure that the companies that you buy these products from, the actual vendors, the manufacturers, if they have something about security on their web pages, do they have a vulnerability disclosure program? Do they at least seem aware that such thing exists as to what they need to do? You also need to consider yourself. What do you find risky? Are you okay with a company knowing that every time you open the app, it's connecting to their server? There is a log generated that you connected to the server. So that means you're probably going to be using the toy. Are you okay with that? On a technical level, they do need to be somehow aware of who you want to connect to. If you're doing a remote session, some of these apps have audio, video, and text capabilities. Capabilities. Again, that is being sent through a computer you do not control. Are you okay with that? My guess is that the majority of people are okay with that. But you need to ask yourself. If you're not, there are a ton of manually operated devices still on the market that are great and do the trick. And stick to like old-fashioned phone calls and imagination, things like that.
When you say, most people just don't care, or most people, are pretty open to it, I oftentimes think that part of that is that the risks are invisible, right? And if the risks are invisible, oftentimes we don't know we're taking the risk. And part and parcel with that is, when this is the dawning realization I've been having this podcast with Stephanie is, when we think about security, we think about things like vulnerabilities. We think about things like, credentials being in clear text so people can reuse them. We maybe think about assets and asset management. But when we talk to everyday people and you say, hey, what do you think about security? What are they thinking about? They think about things like keeping their family safe, keeping their their friends and loved ones safe, you know, protecting their finances, protecting their homes. They don't oftentimes equate the technical security with the personal security.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, the Ashley Madison case, again, shows, because there was people who committed suicide because they were outed having been on that site, and their, you know, social group or whatever, that was a taboo thing. And it was interesting, when I first started this research, there was a vulnerability I found where you could ask the login page, basically, for one of the vendors, hey, I forgot my password. You know, do you have you could basically ask it, does this email address have an account associated? I took a list from the Ashley Madison dump of, you know, .gov and, you know, other interesting domains. Didn't find anything. Dumped my own personal address book, about 300 addresses, ran it through to see if any hits. And I actually had one, which led to a very awkward conversation to confirm my finding. Fortunately, it was somebody that I knew would not be offended by this or anything like that. Turns out they bought some of these devices for some Bluetooth research as well, something else. But yeah, but it was the fact they had to create an account to, you know, activate it and everything. But I got a hit, and it could have been somebody else that I suddenly now know something about them that I maybe never expected. And it's like, that can make things awkward. So it's interesting that, you know, what people want to keep private. You know, if I've got like 30 or 40, I've lost count of how many devices I have now. You know, everybody knows I have these, like I carry around in a wheelie luggage bag as carry-on on a flight, which makes going through TSA so fun. They always want to inspect that bag.
Been there. I've actually had that exact situation at Midway Airport, and it's interesting when they start laying everything out on the table. So, been there.
A couple of things I want to tease out of there. One is, it's important to, if you're registering these tools, maybe not use your main email. Definitely never ever use your work email. Perhaps consider using a disposable email. But the other thing I wanted to jump back, you said something about divorce cases. How would you envision someone saying, look, we're going to send you, Stephanie, all the evidence of GPS tags off of a device? What would that look like?
I mean, first, that would look like me referring them to RenderMan, because I don't know anything about GPS tags. But, I mean, it's not uncommon when I'm doing consultation work about a case, and I'm not speaking about any particular case, obviously.
Oh, obviously, full disclosure.
I've had people ask me to review text messages. I've had people to ask me to explain terms that are used or to give my impressions of a pattern of behavior. One thing that I think is interesting is that, not in expert witness work, but I have had colleagues who work with couples around infidelity, and I've heard more than one story about people being outed when one spouse went to, I don't know, link the doorbell or link a new printer to their phone on their partner's phone, and they notice a sex toy listed in the Bluetooth pairings that they don't own. So, like, and not all of them are wise enough to give the pairing device a different name. Some of them are pretty overt in terms of, you want to be able to find your vibrator quickly, click this button. Exactly. So there absolutely have been cases, not court cases, but client cases that I have heard of where people were inadvertently outed because their phone was linked to a device it shouldn't have been. I've also had my people who were driving down the highway, and all of a sudden their partner's phone lights up, and it's because it has paired to the Wi-Fi signal of a nearby hotel, which, if you're local, is it the cause for questions for those people driving down the highway. I've had that happen a couple of times. So these are things that I don't necessarily people think about or consider until it happens.
And this is why you should always stay at, you know, nice higher end places that all have the same network name at all their locations.
Excellent point. Although that only works if you travel in general. If you are somebody who works down the street and doesn't typically leave or need a hotel much, it will still raise the red flags. The one thing that I am most curious about is how this will play out long term. I wonder, as more and more things become appified, as more devices, not just sexual devices, but health devices. When we were at AVN last month, we met the makers of a new, effectively, cock ring that was programmed to give the wearer health data around their erectile hardness, around their blood pressure, around a lot of different things that seem really super helpful on the surface until you pause and think about the fact that all of that information has to go somewhere. And it becomes very blurry very quickly. And I'm wondering if you could kind of pretend it's the new year and predict the future. What do you see coming down the pipeline in terms of IoT sexual devices of all kinds? And where are you excited and where are you a little bit trepidatious?
If I had to predict the future, a couple of things. I said the data for a sex toy would be used in a court case. I don't think anybody would ever have thought of something like a proving an alibi or something. Something like completely off the wall that you would not be like, well, okay, that actually does. Because, I mean, they've used Fitbits to establish alibis. They've used Fitbits to break alibis and, you know, prove murder. So it's going to be another data source. I highly encourage all the companies that, you know, much like PCI or GDPR or anything, that those rules exist basically to say, if you don't need it, don't store it. Because if you don't have it, you don't have to worry about The other thing that I think is unfortunately going to happen is various countries and regimes are going to start using data from these companies to out homosexuals and others, because companies like Kiru have the ability to pair like devices, so to phalluses, to strokers. So you could basically have a long distance homosexual interaction. Now, if one of those parties is in a country where homosexuality is illegal, and a lot of these countries typically will filter or monitor the internet usage, oh, suddenly that's an interesting piece of information. Now, that could end very badly. Looking at some of the things going on in the States with, you know, anti-trans, LGBTQ harassment and such, it being written into law, you could see, you know, law enforcement going to some of these companies and saying, hey, you know, tell us everybody that's ever, you know, identified as one gender that paired with the same gender.
And it's interesting that you bring up the outing factor. On a positive side of that, Wolf and I were in Jamaica for a sexology training that we attended. And some of our cohort were trans or were gay. More than one of them logged into Tinder while they were there. And it was fascinating because they immediately got a pop-up on their screen saying, your phone is telling us that you're in a location that might not be safe for you. Do you want us to hide the fact that you're online? And A, it's sad and awful that even needs to be a thing. But B, I think that's a great example of what more companies, especially sex tech device companies, should be doing. There should be some way to take the data that they're using and leverage it to protect their users, or to at least give their users options to protect themselves.
Yes, but the bigger issue is they need to do this preemptively. They need to be aware of these threats and deal with them, you know, build it into the security, into the product from the beginning. Because much like the, you know, the warning label of, you know, do not iron pants while wearing, the fact that Tinder does that means that there was probably a reason.
Yeah.
It probably was that somebody got hurt or worse, and they had to put that in after the fact, not preemptively.
This does dovetail into the last question we wanted to ask you. So obviously many people who listen to this podcast are in sex tech, are building new toys, are building new apps. What advice would you give them, and in which way would you like them to reach out to you about Internet of Dongs and about your work?
My major piece of advice for anybody in sex tech and for users is to not be afraid of the technology. Yes, you know, some of the things we've discussed here, the vulnerabilities and that are frightening, but no more so than many, many other products you use on a daily basis and don't think about it. What you need to do is you need to be aware that there are these potential issues. Judge, you know, look at your situation. Is this something that you can handle in your life? And like I said earlier, if you can't, then well, there are still manually operated devices out there. These things are great. During the pandemic, especially, it showed, you know, long-distance relationships, the ability when people couldn't get together in person, it allowed for a lot of relationships to either continue or to blossom at a distance, you know, during the lockdowns. And from a sex therapist standpoint, allowing somebody to explore, maybe they think they're homosexual or something, they could explore what it would feel like, or, you know, emotionally, to connect with someone of the same gender, but, you know, at a distance. I am astounded at the cam model industry, which exploded during the pandemic as well. The interactivity with viewers and the models with these devices, you know, it's the old telephone company to reach out and touch someone just in a new and interesting and private way. It is really an interesting technology. You just need to be aware of the risks and judge your own situation for them. We've got several articles on our website, which is internetofdawn.gs. So Internet of Dongs, but .gs at the end. Info at internetofdawn.gs. I'm also on Twitter at Internet of Dongs. And it's always interested in talking about this stuff. I know, make recommendations on toys that, you know, there's lots of sites that do those kind of reviews and everything. Typically don't, you know, offer, say, you know, one is more secure than the other, but can definitely make some very general point you at some resources. We got a bunch of articles about, you know, if you're a customer, if you're a cam model, we're just expanding out to do more about cam models and the general operational security, how to protect yourself. Very useful resource. We're hoping soon to have a one pager that if you're a adult toy store, that you could just, you know, have on the counter of like, what do you need to know? You've heard the stories, you know, what's the truth? Hopefully one day we can get the manufacturers together to agree on a standard and you know, work together to, you know, come up with some common criteria for securing things and kind of keep each other secure. Because the last thing you want is, I wanted is to become like an underwriter lab for sex toys, because he wants to see my face on the outside of the box.
We'll put all those links into the show notes. So if you're listening to this and you're furiously writing that down or trying to figure out where the .gs goes, please check out our show notes. Thank you so much for joining us, RenderMan, and thank you for tuning in to Securing Sexuality, your source for the information you need to protect yourself and your relationships.
Securing Sexuality is brought to you by the Bound Together Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit. From the bedroom to the cloud, we're here to help you navigate safe sex in a digital age.
Be sure to check out our website, securingsexuality.com, for links to the information we've talked about today, as well as our live conference in Detroit.
And join us again for more fascinating conversations about the intersection of sexuality and technology. Have a great week, everyone.